Well, it's Bird Week. You knew, didn't you? So the Science Show brings you signs of the oldest bird ever found in Australia. No, it didn't sound like that. This bird coming up is 105 million years old. Stunning story. We'll also have a vegetarian crocodile for you. No doubt it preferred gluten-free. And fish face. Now, fish face is one of your relatives, and none other than Professor John Long, just back in Australia, says it's a sensational discovery. And if John says so, I'll believe it. I found him in Adelaide. What brought you back to Australia?
Well, I love Australia, Robin. It's hard to stay away, but the offer of a job where I could indulge in research and collect fossils and study them, rather than being an administrator, which is what I've done for the last 8 years, that was the big draw card.
At the Los Angeles County Museum?
Yeah, I was 3 years in Los Angeles as vice president of that museum, and 5 years before that as head of science at Museum Victoria, which was in Australia. But now I can just focus on research, fossil fish, evolution, biology, it's all wonderful stuff.
Recently, you were terribly excited about the publication of findings regarding what I will call fish face, and you wrote a big article for The Conversation. What made you really take that on so seriously as a big deal?
Well, I'd heard about this fossil from my colleagues in China. I knew it was coming out in Nature, but to me it was probably the most important fossil found in the last 100 years. It filled in a gap between an extinct class of animals called the placoderms and the whole of the modern fish fauna leading to the rest of evolution, tetrapods leading up to humans. And to find a missing link in the old sense, where you've got an ancient fish from 400 million years ago with the modern beginnings of the face of the rest of the vertebrate family, to me was just so exciting. I didn't want the press to bodge it up. So I thought I'll take things into my hand and write an article for The Conversation so people could refer to that.
And the follow-up has been quite extensive, hasn't it? Have they mostly got it right?
They have. It's a wonderful team of scientists on that paper. Professor Ju Min is the lead author, Brian Chu from Australia, who was one of my PhD students, and Per Alberg from Uppsala, a very famous evolutionary biologist. So they've done an incredible amount of work for that paper. The fish is three-dimensional and perfect. They've put it through scanners to get the internal anatomy. They've done exhaustive phylogenetic analysis. It's nearly 100 pages of supplementary information in the paper, and the results are very thrilling.
What exactly did it look like?
Pretty ugly looking sort of fish with armoured plates, but it did have a lower jaw made of multiple bones and an upper jaw called a maxilla, which we have, forming the upper jaw of a human skull. And the lower jaw is the dentary in a human, and that bone is the first time it appears in an evolutionary sequence. So placoderms were thought to be a dead end of no interest to human evolution. Now we know they go right back, and that placoderms were the origin of much of the human body plan, like the origin of paired hind limbs, which are legs, the origin of jaws and teeth, the origin of those bones that form part of the face, and even the origin of having three semicircular canals in our inner ear instead of two.
Remind us, you said right far back, how far back?
Entelonathus lived 430 million years ago. I know the literature, and we quoted 419 because they were quoting it in their paper, but the actual dating has been modified in the latest geological timescale, so 430 million years old.
And where is this fossil?
The fossils were found in Yunnan in southern China from a new site that these colleagues have been excavating for the past 5 or 6 years. They found this fish in 2010, and it took 3 years of careful study and doing the analyses to get the interpretation correct.
And that's where the fossil is now?
Yes, it is. I'm looking forward to going over there sometime next year and seeing it for myself.
Does this imply there might be more fossils there in that site?
There is. Professor Ju Min, the author of that paper, was here in Australia only 2 weeks ago for the conference on Australian vertebrate paleontology we had at Flinders University. And he was able to show us a lot of these other undescribed new discoveries from that site, which are going to rewrite the basal evolution of vertebrates. They're just so fantastic.
Now you're back. You're going to do science, lots of digging. You'll go back to GoGo, presumably, in Western Australia, your favourite site, but what else?
Well, there's a lot of sites in Central Australia that haven't been looked at for a number of years. Much, much older sites, older than GoGo. And I'd like to have a bit of a look around them and see what we can find about the origin of jawed vertebrates, not the well-established jawed vertebrates, but the beginning of that radiation.
Thank you.
My pleasure, Robin.
And it's a real pleasure having John Long back here. He's Strategic Professor in Paleontology at Flinders University in South Australia. Strategic. Never come across one of them before. Now for that ancient bird. The scientific paper is about to be published. One of the authors lives in Georgia, and Sharon Carlton went to find him.
Far away, in a small office on the other side of the world, a university paleontologist made an astounding discovery, all to do with Australia's ancient fossil records. Dr. Anthony Martin at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, has spent the last couple of years, on and off, studying some interesting footprints on a block of stone from Victoria, which date back more than 100 million years. Tony Martin imagines the days when the footprints were actually made.
This place, which is now Victoria, was actually close to the South Pole at that time. So it was a polar environment, cold and dark during the winter, more similar to what you would see, say, in Hobart today, only take Darwin and put it down there. Very, very different from how Australia is today, much closer to the South Pole. Then these tracks specifically were preserved along a river floodplain. So you think about a river channel, it's the spring. The thaw has just happened, so there's been torrential flooding as a result of this thawing out of the ice and snow from that polar winter. Those torrential runoffs have also scoured a lot of the surfaces clean, so now you have these beautiful, extensive sand flats on either side of the river once the floodwaters have subsided. Now think about dinosaurs walking across those surfaces, leaving beautifully expressed three-toed tracks. Also think now, for the first time, about birds, and birds flying overhead, landing onto the sand flat. And as one of them lands, its rear toe leaves a long impression from where its claw drags across the sand. Now let's go 105 million years into the future to... Men are walking along this part of the Victoria coast, now called Dinosaur Cove. They're looking for bones, but they're also on the look for any sort of tracks that might be out there. They spot this slab of rock in the surf zone, and if you've ever been down there, it's fairly dangerous work. So they spot this rock in the surf zone, and they spot three tracks on this rock. They're brave enough, one of them goes back and recovers it. And the two men are Sean Wright and Alan Tate.
Sean Wright and Alan Tate are both volunteer dinosaur diggers with Museum Victoria.
Sean spotted the tracks, and then Alan also photographed them and confirmed them, sent the photographs to me and Tom Rich.
Dr. Tom Rich is curator of vertebrate paleontology at Museum Victoria.
3 months later, he came back, broke the rock into four pieces, and carried it out of there. Now, again, if you've ever been to Dinosaur Cove, I was thoroughly impressed to hear about that, because I think it was probably about 30 to 40 kilograms of rock he carried out there on his back. But it's fortunate he did, because then about 4 or 5 months later, I came to Museum Victoria, took a look at the tracks, and confirmed, yes, they were indeed tracks. The question was, were they dinosaur tracks? Were they bird tracks? If they were bird tracks, they would be the oldest bird tracks known in Australia. That's very exciting right there. I expected that they would be dinosaur tracks from what you would call theropod dinosaurs or so-called non-avian dinosaurs, because today we now know that birds are dinosaurs. Well, it was amazing. Within the first 5 minutes of looking at these tracks, I realized at least one of them had to be from a bird. And that was the one that had a really long gouge mark from its rear toe from when it landed onto the sand flat 105 million years ago.
What did they look like?
Think of them heron-sized or egret-sized. Think of them as being about maybe 40 centimeters tall at the hip. So then have their neck above that. Of course, they have feathers on them, but a lot of the theropod dinosaurs were also feathered. But they had wings. So think about them with their wings now tucked. They've just landed, and they're walking around on the sand flat, perhaps looking for food. Perhaps it's a male-female pair that are there flying together. And think about some of the sounds that might have been in the air, too. To me, that would have been one of the most wonderful parts of going back to the Mesozoic, is just hearing, what were those bird calls like? What were the dinosaurs saying to one another back then? It must have been remarkable.
And how much can you tell from these footprints?
Quite a bit, even though these are three isolated footprints that I think are from three individuals, two of them birds, one of them probably a theropod dinosaur. I can tell you approximately how big they were, a little bit about their behaviors from each of the three footprints, because they left these detailed structures around the outlines of their feet that showed how their feet moved, how they twisted, in the instance of one of them, how it landed, or some of the other nuances of behavior that I often see while I'm tracking modern birds or other modern animals. So there's actually quite a bit you can tell. And then being able to pinpoint exactly what kind of animal might have made these tracks.
When you say feathers, are they exactly the same feathers as we imagine on birds today? And colors? What colors?
Oh, we actually know a lot about dinosaur colors now from the feathers. This was just recently discovered, just a few years ago. The feathers, sometimes the best preserved ones, have these structures called melanosomes. These are structures that reflect pigments. What's very cool about that is the pigments that we see in these melanosomes today, we can compare to the structures we see preserved in fossil feathers. So now paleontologists can actually tell us whether some of these dinosaurs or birds that had feathers, whether they were iridescent, whether they had red, white, maybe black in those colors, and tells us something about some of the patterns they might have had in those feathers, which, of course, were used for species recognition and mate attraction.
And any ideas about our feathered friends here?
I wish. Now, in deposits of the same age north of there at Coonawarra, other paleontologists, I think including Tom Rich, they have found feather impressions, only a few. Now, those are in a lake deposit, the Coonawarra Lake deposit, actually, which is a little bit older, I think around 115 million years old. But there's the problem. We don't know if the feathers came from dinosaurs. We don't know if they came from birds. Also, the only other fossil record we have of birds in that part of Australia is a single furcula, which is more or less the wishbone. That's the only piece of evidence we have of birds being in all of southern Australia. That one bone, along with the feathers, which we don't know are from birds or dinosaurs, and now these tracks. And that, to me, is what is so thrilling, so exciting about these tracks. It's a start in the trace fossil record of birds in southern Australia during the early Cretaceous period. To me, that's absolutely thrilling.
Dr. Anthony Martin at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, with Sharon Carlton, and as I said, that paper's in the press. So it's not just Queensland where the big finds are being made. Go to Museum Victoria and you'll see a big room underground, chock full of bony treasures being identified. That's where Eric Fitzgerald shows me a very large tooth. Okay, you've got something in front of you that looks a bit like a brown tooth. Eric, what is it?
It's actually a tooth that is about the size of your thumb, or an average human thumb, and it's the tooth of an ancient reptile that swam in the rivers of Victoria about 110 million years ago.
And what would you call it?
We've identified it as a pliosaur, which is a relative of the more well-known, I guess, plesiosaur. And plesiosaurs, of course, are the almost snake-necked marine reptiles with four flippers that have been described as what you would get if you took a turtle's body and then stuck a snake through the shell. So you have a little tail and a long neck with a small head. But the pliosaurs are a different beast. The pliosaurs were similar body form to a plesiosaur, so four flippers, not too unlike a seal or sea lion, but with a relatively short neck and a crocodile-like head or skull.
So we're not talking dinosaur?
Most definitely not. Plesiosaurs and pliosaurs and things like ichthyosaurs or fish lizards are often confused with dinosaurs, but they're quite unrelated.
From this tooth, how can you tell what it belongs to?
Well, that's a really great question, because for a long time, in fact, since 1994 until just this year, it had remained unidentified. And there was a question mark. Was it a dinosaur tooth? Was it a crocodile tooth? Was it maybe even the tusk of a strange early relative of mammals, something called a diacynodont? And we weren't really sure. And that's because this tooth is quite different to any other animals we would anticipate, and that's a key word, anticipate finding in sandstones that formed at the bottom of a river. What we finally worked out, and it was thanks to an insight from a visiting researcher, Roger Benson, from the University of Oxford, was when looking at it, we realised that there were some certain ridges on the enamel and a general conical shape to it that you only tend to see in aquatic reptiles, not crocodiles, not some kind of bizarre fish-eating dinosaur, but these pliosaurs. Until now, pliosaurs had primarily been known from marine deposits, so rocks that were formed at the bottom of shallow seas. So what's really surprising here is that this is a pliosaur that swam up a river and probably was living in a river.
What river where?
Well, the rivers that were formed in what was basically a rift valley that formed at the southern end of Australia while it was just in the initial stages of separating from Antarctica. And those sandstones that the fossils were found were actually in southern Gippsland, in South Gippsland, in the state of Victoria.
What are the chances of your going back and finding more?
Well, there are other hints. We have bits of rib. We have some fragments of vertebrae, which suggest this kind of animal. Future field work is really now directed at finding more of this animal. I like to think that it's really these pliosaurs that were living in ancient rivers of southern Australia that are, to me at least, far more interesting than the dinosaurs that were roaming the land around them.
I'm sure you've thought of this, but give me a picture of what it might have looked like.
Well, from the tooth, we can tell that it represents an animal that is at least 4 metres long. How have we worked that out? Well, we've taken the measurements of this one tooth we have and compared it with the smallest teeth in a range of pliosaur species. And it most closely corresponds in its proportions to the teeth of pliosaurs found in the UK, actually.
Like the Loch Ness Monster.
Well, a bit like the Loch Ness Monster, but actually represented by evidence. Loch Ness Monster is all fine and good, but I want to see a body. So this is a so-called Loch Ness Monster-like animal represented by solid evidence. And those pliosaurs that it most closely corresponds to in proportions are about 4 to 5 metres long.
And it would have been swimming around fishing all day.
I suspect so. However, as we know from crocodiles, which are today a reasonable ecological analogue for a pliosaur, they will feed on anything really that is smaller than them, and indeed some prey that is the same size. So it's not within the realms of impossibility, if you like, that this pliosaur may even have fed on dinosaurs that came to the river's edge to feed or drink.
How special is it in terms of a find for this region?
It is special because until this point, the only aquatic reptiles found in these rocks were relatively small plesiosaurs, probably no more than about 2 metres long. This is an animal twice the size with quite different teeth. Those plesiosaurs have really needle-like teeth, almost something you'd expect to see in, say, a small dolphin. So animals that were specialised for catching small fish. The pliosaur has these much more robust bruises of teeth. And that's really an animal that's specialised for feeding on larger prey with larger bones in the body. So what this is telling us is that there are two distinct species of plesiosaur-like animals swimming in these rivers. And that's surprising. Everywhere else around the world where you have these pliosaurs or plesiosaurs in riverine deposits, they're represented by just the one species. So this indicates that we have two quite disparate types of these swimming in the same environment.
Eric, we're beginning to see with all these ancient creatures that whereas I actually had somebody from the American Museum of Natural History a few years ago on the science show saying that, well, there are no real dinosaurs in Australia. No, there's nothing particularly big. Now, in northern Queensland and around Dinosaur Cove near Geelong, you're finding huge monsters. And now in Gippsland, what's going on?
There's a couple of things going on here. Fossils here are hard won, particularly fossils from the age of dinosaurs, the Mesozoic era. So we have to work much harder in Australia to get relatively little reward. Furthermore, there just aren't that many paleontologists in Australia, and there probably never will be. It's a big area to cover, and there's not the same population size, budget, etc., to support a vast number of paleontologists as there are in, say, North America. However, people have come up with new ways of finding fossils, and in Queensland around Winton, they've worked out how to find at least some dinosaur fossils of a particular size range, so larger dinosaurs in that area. Here in Victoria, we use the approach of really going to areas where we know the geology is probably conducive to preserving these sorts of fossils, and then having at it with hammer and chisel, rock saw, jackhammer, and really finding whatever we can. And that's why often they're fragments. The geology rarely preserves more complete associated skeletons that you might have classically found in China or the Western United States, Canada, or say the Gobi Desert in Mongolia. But what we do find is quite different to elsewhere, and that's what makes it really worthwhile.
Eric Fitzgerald curates pliosaurs and various terrible giant lizards in Museum Victoria. He's also got some pretty large diprotodons, but that's for another day. This is The Science Show on RN, where we now leap to Edinburgh, to Scotland, where Steve, an old friend with more dinosaur associations, has just arrived. Steve, I last talked to you about dinosaurs in New York here at the Natural History Museum, the wonderful museum just off Central Park. And now you're in Edinburgh, the University of Edinburgh, where I think Conan Doyle, who wrote Sherlock Holmes, he was here. And indeed, Charles Darwin, in this very department, he was studying something else. Was Charles Darwin in this building at all?
Darwin wasn't in this building, I don't think. I think this was built after he was here, but he was a medical student here for a couple of years in the 1820s. And poor Darwin, he didn't really like the sight of blood. He hated the lectures. He thought they were boring. So he spent most of his time up by the Firth of Forth, this waterway north of here, collecting barnacles and other things with Robert Grant, who was his mentor here. And that's how he really got started as a naturalist.
But you, Steve, obviously have learned to enjoy being in Edinburgh because you come from New York City. I mean, the most wonderful place on earth, in some people's opinion, and you're enjoying yourself in Scotland?
It's a different world here, that's for sure, but we love New York. I've also had a really nice time over the last 7 or 8 months settling into here, my first academic position, building up a lab, starting to teach, and it's been a real blast, really. There's a lot of interesting work that we're doing here in paleontology in Scotland these days.
For instance, looking at the death of the dinosaurs, what more is there to explain about the extinction of dinosaurs?
One of the things that we talked about last time, you know, a few years ago in New York, was work that we were doing on the origin of dinosaurs, how dinosaurs got their start, why they became so successful. But the mirror image question of that is, what happened to the dinosaurs? Where did they go? Why did they go extinct? And it's that question, probably more than any other question in the history of paleontology, has generated more debate, more argument, more intrigue. And we've learned quite a lot about that, but there still is an ongoing debate about it.
Partly the fact that we think it happened quite quickly, and other people suggest it took about 1 million years.
Yeah, that's true. There's been this debate for many years about whether the extinction was abrupt, you know, abrupt in geological terms. So it took maybe a few tens or hundreds or maybe a few thousands of years, very abrupt geologically, or whether it was more prolonged. Maybe it took place over 1 million years, or maybe it was even a 10 or 20 million year gradual decline.
How do you find that out, the answer to that question?
We can look at trends in dinosaur evolution over, say, the final 20 million years of the Cretaceous, from about 85 to about 66 million years ago, the final stanza of the dinosaurs. And we can look at how dinosaur diversity was changing. And so we did a project like that. Last year we published this. And what we were able to identify was that some groups of dinosaurs were undergoing some long-term declines, whereas other groups were not. So that seems to indicate that the picture of the dinosaur extinction, that story, is a little bit more complicated than just an asteroid falling out of the sky and killing off dinosaurs, you know, some Tuesday morning.
Yeah, because it might have happened on Wednesday as well. And indeed, you've got so many different species that obviously they're affected in different ways. What was the main thing that you seemed to be finding in the fossil record that knocked them off?
We looked particularly at the diversity of anatomical features in dinosaurs over those 15 million years, right towards the end. What we saw is that groups of large plant-eating dinosaurs, things like the horned dinosaurs, Triceratops, those kind of animals, and also the duck-billed dinosaurs, these dinosaurs with these fantastic crests on their skulls. Those two groups seem to have been undergoing a decline over that time, but the carnivorous dinosaurs and smaller plant eaters, those groups seem to have been pretty steady over that time. So it looks like there was some kind of major restructuring of dinosaur communities, in particular with the main big plant eaters at the bottom of the food chain, over those 10 to 15 million years, right before the asteroid hit.
One would imagine when the asteroid does hit, you'd have a kind of nuclear winter effect, much less sun. Who knows what happened in the atmosphere? And you'd expect less plant growth and therefore less food for them. Is that right?
Yeah, it would have been a Jerry Bruckheimer movie, for sure. There would have been a big impact. Dust would have been thrown into the atmosphere, nuclear winter, hot and cold spells over the course of a short period of time, but also global wildfires, big tsunamis, earthquakes, all kinds of very sudden global changes. And we don't really, thankfully, have much experience with those kind of things in our modern world, but occasionally we do see big volcanic eruptions or other disturbances that very quickly, very suddenly, very devastatingly affect an ecosystem and everything is wiped out.
And of course, not quite everything, because some dinosaurs did survive and became birds, and there are other creatures which obviously lived on in the water, like crocodiles. What are you doing with crocodiles?
Yeah, so another thing that we're doing quite a bit here in Edinburgh is working on a really peculiar group of crocodiles that lived during the time of dinosaurs, but they didn't live on land, they lived in the oceans. And that's a really weird thing for crocodiles, because if we think of crocodiles today, they're not a very diverse group. There's only about 25 species. They're all kind of the same. They all lurk around the edge of the water. They're all predators. They all move quite slowly. But this really is a very poor picture of the diversity of crocodiles over their entire evolutionary history. So crocodiles originated right around the same time dinosaurs did, about 230 million years ago or so. And in the fossil record, we have crocodiles that were really fast, things the size of a dog that look kind of like a greyhound. We have plant-eating crocodiles. We have armored crocodiles. We have crocodiles with all kinds of weird spikes coming out of their skulls. But I think the weirdest of all are these ocean-living crocodiles that we're studying.
Well, how big?
Well, these things are called metrorhynchids, and they lived in the Jurassic and the Cretaceous, and some of them got to be pretty big. Some of them got to be probably about 7 or 8 meters long, the general size of big sharks and many whales in today's oceans.
Their kidneys must have been unbelievably efficient.
It must have been. You know, we don't unfortunately know anything about that. But one thing, Robin, that's really interesting about these crocs that we do know is that they had huge salt glands in their skulls. We have these big openings in their skulls. And by comparing the anatomy of these skulls with that of living animals, we can tell there was a big salt gland there. And that's something that's really important for an animal that evolved from ancestors that lived on land, like a crocodile. If they're going to go and live in the ocean, they have to find a way to regulate salt. So these animals, that's just one of many features that these crocs had that made them perfectly adapted to a completely aquatic way of life.
You said just now plant-eating crocodiles. Now, if you look at those great big jaws and those teeth, they don't remind you of eating lettuce or spinach.
They certainly don't. Certainly not among living crocs. Although I'm sure living crocs do ingest plants from time to time, but living crocodiles are meat and fish eaters. That's what they're made for. And these marine crocodiles from the Jurassic and the Cretaceous, they were also meat and fish eaters. But there were some other crocodiles that lived on land alongside the dinosaurs that ate plants. And we can tell that because their teeth are not these sharp, serrated, knife-like teeth. They have these very coarse denticles, these very large bumps on them that in living animals, we know those kind of teeth are adapted for eating plants, for grinding up plant material.
Steve, I can't help noticing, as I said at the beginning, that you're here in Edinburgh. And when you go out fossil hunting for either dinosaurs or crocodiles, Where would you go from here?
Scotland is a really remarkable place for fossils, and I think that's something that a lot of people don't realize. So we have a number of things in Scotland that are really unique. Some of the oldest land-living vertebrates, our oldest ancestors, essentially, the fish that emerged and walked onto land, you know, well over 350 million years ago. And some of the best fossils of these animals are from sites in Scotland, especially around the Scotland-England border region. Another thing we have here in Scotland is some really important fossils from the Triassic and the Jurassic, including some dinosaurs. In the Jurassic, in particular, the Isle of Skye, one of the Hebrides, a really beautiful island off the west coast of Scotland. It's one of the only places on the planet that has a good succession of Middle Jurassic rocks, rocks from the time that dinosaurs were really becoming dominant and the earliest mammals and other things were scurrying around underfoot. So Scotland is a neat place for fossils.
Dr. Steve Brusati with his Crocs Eating Spinach at the University of Edinburgh. The Science Show on RN. And our PhD this week from the West studies not spinach but Banksias.
Australia is fortunate to have a diverse and unique flora, and one of the most iconic groups of plants is Banksia. Sir Joseph Banks collected the first specimens in 1770 during James Cook's first expedition. There are known to be around 170 species of Banksia, including those first described on the east coast by Banks, the namesake of the genus. The southwest corner of Western Australia is brimming with biodiversity. 90% of all Banksia species occur here, and the area surrounding Perth is covered with Banksia woodland, growing in a Mediterranean-type climate with hot, dry summers and cool, wet winters. Banksia woodlands are highly diverse ecosystems, which support a large number of species, including the endangered Carnaby's cockatoo and pygmy honey possum. But scientists are worried. They're observing changes to the Banksia's environment. Western Australia's southwest is a harbinger of change, one of the first places in the world to show the impacts of climate change. The area is experiencing a drying climate, with annual rainfall having decreased by around 15% since 1975. This decrease in rainfall is having a profound effect on groundwater levels. Beneath Perth and the surrounding area is a large reservoir, the Nangara Groundwater Mound. In many places, the groundwater table is shallow and within reach of plant roots, including Banksia. However, as the climate dries and as Perth residents use more groundwater, levels are falling and Banksia are suffering. My name is Caroline Canham and I've recently completed a PhD at the Centre for Ecosystem Management at Edith Cowan University. My research set out to see how adaptable Banksia are to changes in the availability of groundwater. In the early 1990s and in 2010, large areas of Banksia woodland suddenly died during a particularly hot, dry summer. There's little doubt that less water is leading to a decline of native vegetation across the southwest. But plants are adaptable, and we aim to determine just how fit they could be. Plant species, like humans, vary in their fitness and their ability to adapt to change. Some plant species, such as the swamp Banksia, are analogous to couch potatoes, living and lounging around in relatively comfortable conditions. But if conditions change, like a drop in the water table, the couch potatoes are thought to be less able to adapt. In contrast, the athletes of the plant world, such as the candlestick Banksia, are able to respond quickly to change and survive. I wanted to test how Banksias respond to decreasing water table levels, focusing on the ability of roots to chase water. The Australian Research Council and the Water Corporation of WA supported this line of inquiry, as the findings will help with planning groundwater pumping regimes and minimise environmental impact. The first step was to examine how Banksia roots interact with the water table throughout the year. In the Mediterranean climate of Perth, the water table rises by up to 1 metre in winter and spring as rainfall seeps into the ground. The water level then falls during summer and autumn. I found that as the water table gradually fell over summer, roots grew longer to chase the groundwater. The slow root elongation following the water table in summer is the natural course of events, and shows that plants will follow a falling water table at a slow rate. In the first of two experiments in the glasshouse, the maximum rate of root growth by seedlings was determined and was found to be particularly fast, considerably faster than the rate that adult plants grew in the field under natural conditions. However, in a second experiment using older trees, the plants would only tolerate water table decline at slow rates. A bit like humans, plants are more adaptable when they are younger. This is supported by evidence from the field. Older, mature trees are often the first to die from drought stress. Thus, rapid changes in the water table are likely to harm Banksia, although plants can tolerate slow changes which give them time to adjust. The drying trend being experienced in the southwest of Western Australia has vital implications for vegetation that relies on groundwater. Plant species that are relative couch potatoes, in terms of their ability to adapt, require groundwater pumping at slower rates. Roots will follow the falling water table if it is slow enough. In the long term, the decrease in water availability is likely to result in significant changes in the composition of species and the structure of vegetation in this globally recognised biodiversity hotspot. Future research will focus on the bigger picture, looking at changes to plants in response to water availability. This will help manage water in response to climate change to ensure the future longevity of our beloved Banksia woodlands.
Dr. Caroline Canham at Edith Cowan University in Perth, now a research fellow studying plants and climate. And don't you love that image of the roots chasing the falling water? Pictures of that on our website. Now, it's useful to have short and long-term weather reports to help track changes affecting trees like that. But how would you do a five-day weather report from 100 million years ago? That's the kind of research Simon Redfern does at Cambridge.
Well, I could give you a five-day weather report from up to 200 million years ago. So the work we're doing on ancient climates comes from measurements of plankton. And plankton in the ocean, as they grow a shell, and the shell records the sort of chemical signature of the ocean that they're growing in. So it changes with the pH of the ocean, the acidity. It changes with the temperature. And in particular, paleoclimatologists have been trying to record past climate over millions of years, and we can do it from things like ice cores for tens of thousands of years. But when you want to go back into ancient geological time, then you look at sediments on the ocean floor, and they date back to the oldest for about 200 million years. And these plankton, as they die, they fall into the sediment, they get trapped there, then you can pick them out from cores that you drill into the ocean, and by measuring the shell, you can get a measurement of the temperature that the plankton grew in. And up to this point, people have been taking these whole organisms, crushing them up, putting them into their machines to make the measurements. And what we've been doing is we've been looking at the nanoscale, at the growth of the shell, and actually we can measure daily bands of changes in chemistry across the width of the shell and see the day-night variations in the chemistry from hundreds of millions of years ago.
And what sort of temperatures, what sort of readings are you getting?
The temperature that you get will depend on the time. So everyone is very concerned at the moment on global climate change. And the importance of this work is it gives an idea of the variations in temperature over geological times.
What's the hottest you've seen the oceans to be in your studies?
Now, I can't give you a precise answer to that, because what we're doing is we're looking at particular isolated samples where we're looking on the tens of nanometer resolution. That's billionths of a fingernail in size. And those readings from one organism can't give you huge variations. What my colleagues who are geochemists are doing is measuring extremes in temperature over Earth history, and there, at some points in Earth history, there are indications that the entire planet was frozen, so that we had ice going from the poles to the equator. So clearly there, the oceans would have been, you know, at temperatures of zero or less. Other periods in Earth history, we have times of much warmer climate, and you can have global temperatures much higher than today even.
Later in this program, I'm going to broadcast an interview from Tasmania on the tides of coccolithophorids, which can produce gigantic tides and have done over the millions of years. Are there any of your samples occasionally?
Coccoliths are one type of plankton. They produce a carbonate shell. The sorts of plankton that we've been looking at are called foraminifera, forams, which grow together in the same oceans as coccoliths. Nice thing about forams is when they die, they retain their entire shell. What tends to happen with coccoliths is they fall apart. They're made up of lots of little platelets to form a sphere. They're beautiful organisms. Forams also, if you look at them under the microscope, provide all sorts of amazing shapes and patterns in their structures. So we're looking at particular species that you can identify. We know exactly where these things grow. But you get these blooms of plankton from input of nutrients into the ocean. And you have a whole ecosystem of plankton growth. So you have the plant photosynthesizing plankton, and then the sorts we're looking at which actually eat those, which are the zooplankton, the animal plankton.
Simon Redfern is professor in earth sciences at Cambridge. Now to those coccoliths and their friends. Why should you care? Well, their absence would take your breath away. I'm with Professor Gustav Hallegraaff in Hobart. Many people think that our oxygen comes mainly from forests. They are the lungs of our city, but in fact, the forests absorb almost as much oxygen as they give out. Where do our breaths come from?
So a lot of people in the street don't really know or respect the microscopic plankton algae of the world oceans. And in fact, every second breath of oxygen that we take comes from the microscopic algae in the oceans. The second breath of air comes from the higher plants on the land.
They exude oxygen, and that just fills the atmosphere in general, does it?
That's right. And of course, these organisms were here way before the land plants. These organisms evolved already 3.5 billion years ago. And the land plants are relative newcomers. They only turned up about 400 million years ago. So a lot of the oxygen that actually accumulated in our atmosphere first came from the marine microscopic algae.
Now, these microscopic creatures, the algae, as you say, they come and go in vast populations. Some are okay and some are very harmful. I remember going over the mountains and I could see Jervis Bay, which had gone the most incredible, I think, greenish colour, and it was almost glowing. And sometimes we have red blooms. These are not good.
Okay, yes, I'm well familiar with that Jervis Bay algal blooms in 1999 or something. Basically, overnight, it colored Jervis Bay a milky green. The local people really had never seen anything, and initially they blamed effluents from the local milk factories. This, in fact, was a completely natural event. It's just a single-celled species that found itself in the right environmental conditions of temperature and nutrients. These organisms can divide sometimes 5 to 10 times per day. So you just need a week of favorable conditions and the whole bay turns milky white. So this particular organism, a coccolithophorid, was in fact a good species. So it does a lot of photosynthesis. So it takes carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, so it clears out the greenhouse gases. And in exchange, it gives us land animals oxygen. So this was a good species. Now, a week later, that organism was gone, and there really were no harmful effects of that particular organism. But yes, there are other algal species that can cause us harm. For listeners that lived in Sydney, were in Sydney in November last year, there were about 13 beaches, including the famous Bondi Beach. Suddenly, on a blue Monday, it just was colored like blood. And people looked at it in amazement. You know, where did that come from? What is it? So these are organisms that I've been working on for more than 40 years of my life. So that, again, was a relatively harmless species. The only harm it really did cause that people at that day in Sydney could not go in the water. If they would have done so, they would have probably developed maybe some skin rashes. The surfers liked it. They had their wetsuits on, and that organism was, in fact, bioluminescent at night. And surfers loved that.
They didn't look as if they were covered in blood, though, did they? The all red stuff.
No, it just drips off. So that was, you know, a borderline what we call harmful algal blooms. But there are other species of algae that can cause devastating, harmful impacts on human society. There are some species that exude chemicals in the water and can kill fish. And whereas wild fish stocks can deal with that somehow, they sense that there is something in the water that irritates their gills and actually swim away. For example, we are aware that whole herring migrations sometimes change their regular paths to avoid such an algal bloom. Now, when an algal bloom like that, a fish-killing algal bloom, enters a major aquaculture area, and that happened in 1996 in Port Lincoln, where they just then established a big tuna aquaculture operation that basically overnight killed $45 million worth of cultured tuna. So we need to understand these phenomena. We need to have monitoring programs in place.
That's in South Australia.
That's in South Australia. Yeah, we need to have monitoring programs in place and come up with all kind of mitigation strategy. Like the first thing, if you are operating a fish farm, and we're running fish farms here in Tasmania, you have at least one person on staff that almost every day takes a water sample, see what's in there. If you see such a harmful algal bloom develop, then you start to be on the alert and you start to think, you know, you watch for concentrations to rise. Then you start, the first thing is stop feeding the fish so that the fish are less active, staying on the bottom in the cages. They're not coming in contact with the algae. When it gets worse, you tow away cages. That happened in Port Lincoln in South Australia. You had an incident like that in Tasmania in 2003. And then if it gets worse, then you really need to do much more drastic things. And I'm working with some Korean scientists where we learned that there are special clays that actually mop up all of these toxic chemicals and at least gives the fish an immediate relief.
These are clays like the soil.
Naturally derived soil kind
of. But you need an awful lot of soil, wouldn't you?
Yeah, but you just sprinkle them on the surface of the water and it gives the fish an immediate relief. So in Korea, they have annually recurrent algal blooms in a major aquaculture area, and they over time learned that this is the only way they can deal with it. Otherwise, you know, they have to move that whole aquaculture to another location.
How much does it cost Tasmania, the harm that's done by not being able to manage these blooms properly?
I started to develop this expertise when I was still in Europe, and in Europe and also North America and Japan, we've known of these phenomena for a long time. In fact, the very first record of a really harmful algal bloom that potentially could kill people dates back to Captain Vancouver when he landed in what is now called Vancouver in 1793. Some of his crew jumped the ship, ate a meal of blue mussels, and five of those people actually died from a phenomena that we now have coined paralytic shellfish poisons. So these microscopic algae, just like there are berries in the forest that can be toxic, there are mushrooms that are toxic to human beings and we learn not to eat them. So there are particular algal species that produce chemicals that have a completely natural functions for the microscopic algae, but they have toxic impact higher up the food chain. So Captain Vancouver was very intrigued what was going on and tried to communicate with the local native Indian tribes. And these Indian tribes made it clear to him, you stupid Europeans, don't you know that when the water is bioluminescent, you don't eat shellfish? So that was really the very first known algal bloom monitoring program. And over time, Western society has caught up on this knowledge that the native Indians already had. We do it through all kind of fancy technologies. We now use molecular probes to test for different species in the water. If a species is present, that potentially has harmful impact, we start to test all of the seafood products for toxins, and according to the toxin levels in seafood, we close particular fisheries. Now, we had such a problem most recently in November last year in Tasmania. And in fact, we were caught out somewhat. Even so, we had a monitoring program in place. The plankton communities in the east coast of Tasmania, that is a climate change hotspot, so the whole marine ecosystem is changing. This is an organism that's called dinoflatulate, Alexandrium tamarense. We had seen it as early as 1982, but it was always in very low concentration, so we didn't worry about it. And a lot of our monitoring effort had been focused on other areas where we had different species that was causing problems, like the Ewan River, the Antarctic Channel. So that left that whole east coast of Tasmania basically uncovered by any monitoring progress. And suddenly there was an algal bloom there. And unfortunately, it escaped our initial monitoring, so some mussels were exported to Japan, and these people have much better monitoring programs than we have. And they picked up the toxins. Yeah, that is not looking good.
So, no. But I actually heard it cost you about $12 million.
That's correct. So, well, the first thing that happened, that led to a global recall, not just of Tasmanian shellfish, it led to a global recall of all Australian shellfish. That is how international markets respond. We call this the halo effect or the public court system. And then we still are assessing the impact of that incident. Then we had to close in Tasmania, harvest of mussels, oysters, scallops. There was some concern of abalone. They appear to be only very minorly contaminated. But the biggest cost actually was we found that the digestive system of lobsters was contaminated. And that was just before the Christmas season. So there was a lot of discussion, what are we going to do about the lobsters? It would have been possible, for example, still to market the lobsters, but as a tail only, with all of the digestive system removed. But the industry itself, and I can understand where they come from, decided that would devalue their product and they didn't want to go there. So also a lot of lobster fisheries were closed. And that has cost Tasmania at least $12 million.
Going back to what you were saying before about how so many of these algae and other creatures in the ocean absorb carbon dioxide, they have also fairly robust shells, even though they're tiny. What happens when the acidity level of the ocean goes up? Will they be affected and will they therefore not be able to absorb as much CO2 from the atmosphere as before?
Climate change has many different aspects to it. One of them, indeed, we get increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and that actually stimulates photosynthesis. So we do an enormous amount of work where we now growing an enormous amount of different Australian microscopic algal species in all climate change scenarios. And actually, the good news is that most microscopic algae will actually grow better. They do photosynthesis better, so they grow faster and they will keep taking more carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. However, there has been some concern expressed, as you correctly refer to, that some species that produce calcareous shells, like the coccolithophorids, that they could potentially be more vulnerable to corrosion by the seawater becoming more acidic. Indeed, some early experiments that were done on the Northern Hemisphere showed this potential effect. So we have been repeating this work, and it appears that there's an enormous variability, that even within one species of coccolithophorid, there are different genetic strains living in different parts of the world that have different sensitivity. So the only thing that we have been able to demonstrate that an organism like coccolithophorids, they will not ever become extinct. They've been here for so long, they're so successful, have such genetic diversity, they can deal with it. They've seen it all. So I still can sleep at night.
Breathing deeply and every second breath coming from these creatures.
Correctly.
The deeply breathing Professor Gustav Hallegraaff from the University of Tasmania, where they've just spent the week discussing climate and oceans and warming with CSIRO. And breathing, no doubt. Next week on The Science Show, the PM's Prize for Science and more birds, as it's Bird Week, living ones this time, and very clever too. And on Catalyst, the second part of Marianne de Mazes' extraordinary report on cholesterol, which smashed the ratings on Thursday. The Science Show is produced by David Fisher and Simon Branthwaite. I'm Robin Williams.
While most of us will have eaten at or used franchise businesses like McDonald's, Hungry Jack's or Jim's Mowing, few of us really understand how these businesses work. For example, did you know
McDonald's only charges $25,000 or $35,000 for the franchise rights, but of course you've got to spend $2.5 to $3 million to build the restaurant. And by the way, you build the restaurant with your money, but McDonald's owns everything.
You can download or stream this Rear Vision from the RN website.